What if we reverse engineered our people strategy? What if we started with why people leave the organization, and then we proactively built our people strategy and programs to address those causes in advance? What kind of a companies can we build if we were really thinking about what might drive somebody to leave and making sure that we exceeded expectations in all of those areas? We're going to be exploring that in today's podcast with Button's VP of People, Stephanie Mardell. She's going to share her journey from executive recruiting to in-house recruiter to head of people and talk about the experience building a people function from the ground up. This episode covers hip-hop, Taco Tuesday, and Omotenashi, and a lot more. So we'll be right back with the conversation with Stephanie after a brief word from our sponsor. 21st Century HR is a podcast exploring how to build better businesses through modern people practices and approaches. It's brought to you by my firm, Amplify. Amplify provides HR executive search and strategic consulting services that help companies build better organizations. From employer brand development and execution to global talent strategies, Amplify develops custom solutions that help clients from Hootsuite to SpaceX optimize their recruiting capabilities. Amplify also hosts a new community for HR leaders called the Ecosystem. The Ecosystem was designed to bring modern HR leaders around the world together to share ideas, inspiration, and support. Learn more at amplifytalent.com. Hey everyone, welcome to the 21st Century HR Podcast. I'm your host, Lars Schmidt, and I am thrilled to be joined today by the VP of People at Button, Stephanie Mardell. Stephanie and I are going to talk about a range of topics spanning from kind of moving and transitioning from recruiting into people leadership and many other things, including hip-hop templates. So we're going to have a lot of fun. Stephanie, if you don't mind, why don't you give the listeners just a brief introduction on your background?
Hi, my name is Stephanie Mardell, and I'm the VP of People here at Button, a mobile commerce startup based here in New York. Prior to Button, I worked at Square, as well as within the executive search world. And I've always been a lover of plants and helping humans reach their fullest potential.
So you have a lot of experience in your career helping humans reach their full potential. I want to kind of rewind the clock back to really the early days of your career. What you spent, you know, quite some time in the recruiting space, both at executive search and in-house before moving into your current role. What initially drew you to recruiting?
That's a great question. Interestingly enough, there were a number of factors, life events, and influences pulling me into recruiting, but it was pulling me into recruiting. So my mother was the executive director of HR at Minnesota Public Television. I interned in career services in college. I worked part-time at an executive search firm, of which I eventually moved into a full-time role there. But if I'm honest here, all of these things, you know, they just paid the most. So it wasn't that I was drawn to them or interested in them. It was just like, I was looking, I was like, oh, $15 an hour. Like, yes. They were kind of a means by which I could then pursue my real passions in college, which were the unpaid internships within foreign policy and cross-cultural communications and strategy. But right before I graduated, I was hit by a car while I was crossing the street, putting me into a year-long recovery. And so I was unable to pursue a job. I had a job offer for the State Department. And so fortunately, the executive search firm I was working for at the time offered me the full-time role, and I couldn't have been more grateful. And to this day, it was probably one of the best and most influential life choices I made. And this executive search firm, you know, usually people, I like to say, you know, end their career in executive search, and I started my career in executive search, and it was for mission-driven organizations. So think Amnesty International, Save Darfur Coalition, the Smithsonian Institution. So these amazing organizations, and I got exposure to these phenomenal leaders, as well as kind of how they approached, you know, leading organizations and building these admirable teams. And it was, I mean, I remember I was 22 years old, and was interviewing Ambassador Chris Hill at the time, who was based in Iraq. And I was like, how am I having this opportunity right now? It was pretty cool.
Well, it's kind of interesting too, because obviously that allowed you to kind of blend your pre-accident plans for your career with executive search in an interesting way that kind of combination is rare. And having recruited in nonprofit and, you know, spent a couple of years at NPR running recruiting innovation for them, I could definitely appreciate the challenges and complexity of recruiting for those types of organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're such important, organizations and institutions.
Yeah. And so when did you know you wanted to make the move from agency to in-house?
So I knew I wanted to make the move from agency to in-house when I was working at Sage Consulting Associates. So Sage was a boutique agency consulting firm, and I spent most of my time leading a team that hired niche talent for all the big tech companies in the Bay Area. So it was my kind of first exposure into the tech industry. And it was interesting during that time because I was working with so many of these, top tech companies, but the experience the candidates had was so inconsistent, right? I saw with one company or with one recruiter, how a great process and the right hire could make a massive impact on the business or the project that they were working on. And on the flip side, I saw how a poor process or, a recruiter was just way over their head, could really reduce or negatively impact the team, the company, and the project or the overall effectiveness of what they were trying to do. So, more often than not, I really saw companies treat candidates poorly, whether it was not following up, not having a good on-site interview process or structured interviews. I remember, I had a couple of candidates on site and the interviews just didn't show up, which I was like, how is this possible?
Right.
The worst candidate experience. Can you imagine just like sitting in that conference room, being like, oh, what am I supposed to do here? or not using the interviewing experience as a reflection of the company brand or employer brand, right? So I made the decision to move in-house because I really wanted to build and be part of creating, a great experience for candidates. Because at the end of the day, when you're looking for a new job or you're transitioning into a new role, a new company, that's a big life decision. There's a lot that goes into that.
Yeah.
It's not an easy thing to do. So fortunately, my boss at Sage Consulting Associates used to work for Brian Power, who interviewed me at Square and gave me a chance to do that at Square. And I didn't even have engineering recruiting experience. I remember during the interview process, he was like, so do you want to recruit engineers? I was like, yes, I think so. I have no idea what it takes, but I'll figure it out.
Right.
But I think he kind of saw that I had a really strong foundation. I valued the right things. I had a lot of grit and he took a chance on me and I think he's still happy with that decision today.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, I think most recruiters, when they make that transition from agency to corporate, like no matter how successful you are and how good you are and effective you are as a recruiter on the agency side, you don't have control. You don't have control of anything on the client side. You can influence, but you ultimately don't have control on that. I think that over time kind of leads to a level of frustration where when you go in-house and there's so many other variables about being in-house where you're building the team and you're building the relationships and really able to watch people grow and develop in their career once you've brought them in. So it's, I think from a kind of rewarding and fulfilling standpoint, it's much less transactional, which is, I think most people that make that shift, they really kind of, they lean on that. For you, you kind of have an interesting background where you went from Square over to Button. You were one of the first 15 hires, I believe, kind of initially coming in with more of a focus on recruiting. And then obviously as the organization grew, you grew with that and your role evolved and you ended up becoming their first head of people. And we're really in an interesting position where you've been able to build the function more or less from the ground up. I'm curious, how did you go about preparing yourself when you're, talking with the CEO and they're talking about, hey, we really want you to kind of move into this broader role and build a team and build a function. It's your first time doing that outside of just kind of core recruiting. How did you begin to prepare yourself for that shift?
So Great question. When I left Square, let me back up. When I joined Square, we were about 400 people. And when I left, we were well over 1,000, approaching 2,000. It was this period of significant growth, not only in San Francisco, but we launched offices in New York and Atlanta. And one of the things that when I moved to New York and I left Square, I was like, I want to join a company early on, because even at 400 employees, a lot of systems, processes, and just culturalisms had already been built around recruiting. And people operations. And so I was specifically going after companies, where I could be a very early employee. And to me, it also, having a CEO invest in recruiting and people operations early on is a great sign, right? Every CEO talks about how important people and culture is, but at the end of the day, you have to put money and resources to it. So Mike Ciccone, Button is very lucky and unique to have a CEO who cares so deeply and puts money where it counts, right? I was employee number 14. And when we started out, when I arrived on my first day, the goal was to hire people. That's like, we just needed bodies, we needed talent. And so we built and scaled out the recruiting processes, and we're really intentional about the type of candidate experience we were providing. And I remember specifically when I was interviewing with Mike Ciccone, our CEO, he said to me, he's like, what does the best candidate experience look like? And he was like, I kind of went through it and gave him my opinions. I remember we were drawing it out on the whiteboard and every milestone or touch point. And he said, great, I want you to build that at Button. I want you to build the best candidate experience, the best recruiting process in the world. Like, can you do that? And I was like, yeah, I'll figure it out. I'll do it. And so that's really what drew me to the company. And so then when we started growing, and we successfully recruited a lot of these wonderfully, talented humans, we had to retain them. So then it was this natural shift in saying, okay, we've got to now build out the people processes and be intentional, just as we were about the candidate experience, on the employee experience, and really constantly reinforce why Button is such a great place to work. And quite frankly, recruiting and people operations are natural extensions of each other. Retention is just recruiting on a daily basis, to make sure that your team wants to, that those humans want to show up every day, right?
Yeah, so many companies don't get that though. So many companies are so heavily focused on recruiting and talent attraction that they don't match that investment with retention and creating an environment that's sticky and they'll actually hold on to the people you've worked so hard to get. So it's I agree with you, but it's funny. So many organizations still look at recruiting as this, somewhat of a disconnected entity from the overall kind of employee experience and talent management process. And I think that's a huge miss.
Huge miss. And one where I think, when I look at how I've built the teams, I've really looked at, I did not use other HR leaders as resources or influencers to how I built things here at Button. I actually looked to product and marketing teams, because at the end of the day, your recruiting team is a marketing team. They're on the front lines, they're ambassadors for the business, for your team, for your culture. And once you have them inside, you're building products, services, programs, and your customers are your people. So if you put on, more of a strategic, leadership, which I think HR is really moving into, and you start thinking about your teams as marketing teams and product teams, it's a different way to look at it. And you wouldn't ship a product that you weren't proud of, right? You wouldn't ship a product that didn't have great 5-star reviews, or you'd be constantly refining, features and functionality to make sure that you got those 5-star reviews.
Right. And that's a great point. And I think it actually kind of ties back to another point that you had mentioned when we first spoke, which was interesting, because I think the way you looked at designing the people function at Button was really, again, kind of leveraging your recruiting experience, almost reverse engineering it, where you first started with okay, why do people leave, right? When you have turnover and, you know, undesirable turnover, what are the reasons that people typically leave? And let's kind of start with those points and let's build a people practice that proactively addresses those issues that you know, damage retention and damage your ability to keep talent. What did that, like, how did you arrive at that point? And how did that actually inform how you kind of built and prioritized the people strategy at Button?
Great question. So I think I may have to patent this approach, quite frankly. It's simple, but it's worked so well. And I really have to give a lot of, it was an aha moment. So I was sitting in, so we here at Button, we host monthly growth workshops, and we'll bring in, we have an executive coach in residence, and sometimes she gives those presentations and those workshops. Other times I do it. So we're developing a lot of content, but it's, you know, not full days. It's usually an hour to 3 hours worth of content, just enough time for people to for people to focus and for their attention spans, you know, to break, essentially. So I was sitting in on an influence and communication workshop that we designed for new managers. And Julia Mallory, our executive coach in residence, who was giving the training, asked our new managers, why do you think people leave companies? And so people, you know, raised their hands, they were shouting out answers. And for the most part, everyone said, for a better role, for more money, they weren't recognized enough, or they wanted to do something new. And she kind of puts up a slide, and, you know, and I guess she kind of paused long enough for us to realize that was probably, you know, we weren't giving her the right answers. And so based on all of these studies she shared, the top reasons why people quit were: one, lack of growth opportunities, promotions, advancement; two, their manager; and three, a lack of community or sense of belonging within the team or the broader company. And so you're right, I reverse engineered this. So, you know, during our yearly planning sessions, I would put these headers up on, you know, whiteboard, or, you know, up on, you know, big, you know, those big massive post-it notes. And I asked the team, or I asked people to say, okay, what are we doing currently that helps us, you know, build, you know, the best community and the most inclusive community? What are we doing currently? What programs or initiatives, you know, are we maintaining, and what do we want to build to help our employees, you know, grow, to help remove ambiguity around promotions and advancement and recognition? And how do we help our managers be the best managers, so people don't quit because they're not good managers? Right. And so, you know, by just doing that exercise and laying out, like, what is everything that we're doing, where are there gaps in our process, then we're constantly able to, you know, nurture what exists, and experiment with new projects and initiatives, or kill things that are not working or are not serving that purpose. And I think it's been a really great model to work from and to plan from and to reflect on.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting. I think when you take that approach, and it's funny, when you probably should patent it, because it's simple, but it's really sharp. And I think that not a lot of people teams really take that approach, right? They're almost like, they look at some of those issues of why people leave as symptoms and things that they have to kind of address at an individual level, as opposed to kind of proactively baking that into how they view the function and how they prioritize projects that really impact the employee experience. So that, you may be onto something. If you're listening to the podcast, you heard it here first. This is a trademark pending. So don't take Stephanie's framework unless we work together. We'll open source it, perhaps.
I'm happy to come facilitate a brainstorm.
All right, that's a deal. Let's talk a little bit about omotenashi. You know, this is as I learn more about kind of the culture at Button, obviously this is a pillar. So tell me a little bit about what, you know, how would you define it, and how did it become a foundation for Button's culture?
So there is no, let's define omotenashi first, because I think, you know, there is actually no direct word-for-word translation into English for omotenashi. But simply put, it is anticipatory hospitality and generosity. So our CEO lived and worked in Japan for some time, and it was a life-changing experience for him. And he, you know, was so inspired, and it was such a profound experience on him, kind of working within the Japanese, you know, business environment, that he wanted to carry those experiences forward in his life and his own business. And so, Omotenashi has been a value since the beginning here at Button. And for us and for Button, it's really anticipating and providing the best experiences possible for our partners, our customers, and also to each other as colleagues, right? So for example, if I'm partnering with someone new, or there's a new manager that joins the company, I stop to think, what is his or her communication preference and working style? What can I do to make it easier to work together? Or I just ask those questions straight out, like, how can I be helpful to you? What do you want to get out of this partnership? Where are the areas where I can provide the most value and most support? And so, and it also breaks down to meetings, right? So I feel like, there are rants on, effective meetings as of late. How do you host the most effective meeting? And meetings are so expensive. But if you were just, stop and think ahead and to think about, how can I anticipate the needs of everyone in this meeting? Well, you're going to have a variety of different styles, but like even something simple as providing, the purpose of the meeting and the agenda in advance or in the calendar invite so people can come prepared. This is often, I think, missing in a lot of cultures and organizations, but it's being thoughtful, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and when you break it down, that makes sense. And I'm curious, like the idea of it makes a lot of sense, and I can certainly see how that can have a pretty profound impact in terms of the culture and the clients and kind of everybody within the ecosystem of Button. How do you evaluate for that, right? In the recruiting process, how do you gauge whether potential future colleagues embrace Omotenashi and they have the kind of disposition and the mindset that will allow them to kind of thrive in that environment?
So we've experimented a couple of different ways. So there are structured interview questions or behavioral interview questions that we can ask to get at it. Past performance is often an indicator of future performance. So if we are, hiring an account manager for our team, we can ask questions that get at how they went above and beyond for a partner and what above and beyond means to them, right? Because for us, it might mean something wildly different than what above and beyond to someone might be like, I sent them a gift bag, when they showed up to our office, where, for Button, it might mean that, we really, investigated kind of what their favorite food was. And we made sure that, that lunch was provided to them when they came on site. We provided them swag. It was their first time to New York. So we got them tickets to, a Broadway show. So, I mean, there are things that you can, there's differences and nuances in kind of what that definition means. So we want to be blown away with kind of those above and beyond things. And I think, second, for many of our roles, we have folks submit a case study or what we call kind of a challenge. And so it typically is very focused on kind of the core competencies of the role. So for anyone who joins our recruiting team, it's, providing us with an overview of kind of what they think the ideal candidate experience look like. What is their role in the process? So really trying to understand kind of how they see themselves, their role, their mission, their purpose as a recruiter. And if folks are like, oh, I'm there to like greet the candidate and fill some roles, well, they're not going to be a good fit for our team. But if someone really takes the time to even in that case study, put our Button logo on, on that case study, format it, put a bunch of polish around it. It's amazing kind of the spectrum of polish that you would get from candidates. And we tend to pick those who go above and beyond with, the polish and presentation.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, hopefully future recruiters that you'll be hiring are listening to this podcast and now they have a leg up on knowing how to make an impression.
That's true.
One of the things, so our mutual friend Brian Power insisted that I ask you about Taco Tuesday. What is the story behind Taco Tuesday?
So this is another moment of brilliance. Probably needs to be tested. we started off early on at Button. I think this was probably within, you know, the first year of the company or so. We started off using the same lingo that most companies use, which is, we want to have some lunch and learns, right? So let's all eat lunch and we'll learn something about each other or about the business. And interestingly enough, we just started hosting them on Tuesdays. So it was kind of a nice, consistent thing that everyone could look forward to. And so for some reason, as we started growing as a company, the catering company that we're using kept sending us tacos on Tuesdays. And so in this, again, moment of punny brilliance, I think a couple of us were sitting around the table and we're like, well, someone's giving a talk and we're eating tacos. We should just brand this Taco Tuesday. And, you know, 4.5 years later, the talks and the tacos are still going strong.
That is amazing. And I'm laughing extra. So I'm going to have to share this with my friend, Marta Riggins, who runs brand and a few other programs at Instacart, because basically all of their programs are based on food puns. So yes. So I will, she gave a talk on that at Culture Apps conference, earlier this month. So yeah, I'll have to actually see if I get her deck, cause I think you'd appreciate that.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
You know, one of the things that I really enjoy when I come across is two people officers and CHROs who are also reasonably prolific writers and sharing their experience. Because I think, especially when you think about 21st century HR, the role of a CPO is also very much, they're the primary recruiter, they're an evangelist, there's so many different things. But part of what they do is they kind of set the tone for the employee experience. And from a branding perspective, people you're going to hire, they're checking you out. They're looking at your blog. They're looking at, social media. They're looking at Glassdoor. They want to get a sense of what you're all about. And when you have a people executive that is, regularly kind of sharing updates on, people programs, projects, culture, things like that, I think it's really helpful for candidates to determine like how they might align or not with that company. And so for you, I know you're fairly active on Medium and Button's blog. Where does that kind of interest in writing come from?
Well, you just made my day, because I always feel like I'm behind and I'm not contributing enough. And I feel like, every quarter I try to give back to the broader community in some way, whether that's through a blog post, whether it's through a panel, speaking engagement. I think, there's so much good stuff that we're doing, for people. And, there's so many people that are evolving the way in which, the workforce functions on a day-to-day basis. And it's really inspiring to learn from people. And I think, for us, we're a smaller company. So I feel like I can offer, kind of really actionable, tangible things that you can do if you're a one or two person team, starting at a small company. And so I also, I got great advice. I can't take credit for this. I got great advice from someone. So if they're listening and it's you that told me this, please, send me an email. But is that you should create an Excel matrix of knowledge for yourself. So the concept of this is that you use broad topics that you have knowledge in, such as recruiting, learning and development, compensation, diversity and inclusion, as the columns, right? And under each column, you list the things that you've done in those areas, right? And it can be big stuff, it could be tiny things. So we created recruiting, we created these really awesome interview guides. So I've been meaning to write a blog post on our interview guides, right? It's something so small, but something that would be so impactful that someone could just pull and use as a template, for their teams. And so then you basically have probably 50 plus things that you can write about. And so if you break your experiences and expertise down, into bite-sized chunks, I think it makes writing and giving back to the community a lot easier.
I think it's You know, you touched on a point that's so important, and that's that I think this idea of open source in HR, or kind of however you frame it, the idea of sharing your learning, sharing your projects, sharing your experience, sharing your mistakes, right? I think when you look at the legacy of HR, it was very much a black box function, right? People operated in siloed, nobody shared anything. It was very rare to kind of get, you know, media updates from people executives on kind of what they were building and what they were learning. And especially as we look at the field right now and the kind of projects and programs that we're driving, and we're doing things today that we didn't do at all 5 years ago, right? So some of this is kind of uncharted territory for the function. When you have more people kind of sharing that path and that journey and those experiences and those missteps and everything involved, that can then be a spark that's going to inspire another CPO somewhere to say, oh, you know what? I'd never thought about solving that problem in that way. Let me take that and kind of localize that for my organization and do something different, and then, you know, hopefully contribute that back. And so the more we get people sharing what they're doing and what they're learning and what their projects and programs are, I think the faster we'll start to see that shift and that evolution from kind of legacy HR to modern HR. And with that, I'm curious from your perspective, when you think about 21st century HR, how would you define that?
So I would define 21st century HR as developing and evolving the most effective products and services for your most valuable resource, which is your people. I think that's it.
I like that. I like that. And we're tying that back to the whole kind of product management and, you know, so that's there's a through line here. I see it. Last question I have for you, Stephanie. One of the things that I aim to do in this podcast is to, you know, obviously illuminate and kind of spotlight CHROs and CPOs that are doing really innovative work in the space. But I also kind of through those conversations, I want to get a sense of who inspires them. And for you, when you think about the leaders in the space that have, you know, informed or supported or inspired your work in HR, who are some of those people that you really look to for inspiration?
There are so many people. And, you know, I could probably provide you a list with, you know, 50 plus people who have given me great nuggets along the way. I think generally, you know, some of the strongest mentors within the people ops space here in New York, because I've only been here for about 5 years. So I would say, you know, Matt Hoffman, who is the former VP of people at DigitalOcean, Cindy Gordon, who's the VP of people at Policy Genius. Both of these folks are kind of approaching culture and teams in really interesting ways and are both incredibly strategic and have really and have great partnerships with their leadership, or have built great partnerships and have really been able to show the value of what great HR looks like, and how it can be a very strategic partner. On the flip side, I also have to just give a shout out, you know, not in the people operations space, but my former boss and mentor, Mona Sang, she focuses on leadership recruiting at Facebook now, but she really taught me how to be a great manager. And I think, you know, great people operations leaders need to double down and know how to be great managers, because you've got to coach. You've got to coach your executives. You've got to be able to coach your line managers. You know, you've got to coach everyone in the new managers who think they want to be managers and think it's going to be like, you know, the easiest thing in the world. I think, you know, really doubling down on management best practices will, you know, those are the greatest mentors as well.
Great. Well, Stephanie, I really appreciate you making some time to come on the show and kind of share your own journey and experience. And I know the listeners will have a lot to take away from this conversation as well. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 21st Century HR. If you want to hear more episodes like this or read stories from the 21st Century HR Fast Company series, go to 21stcenturyhr.com. And if you want to make your podcast just a little more awesome, be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform your ears desire. You'll find all the subscribe links on the website. And if you enjoy the podcast, do me a favor and share it with your peers, your network, your boss, and your CEO. Help me get the podcast into the ears of anyone who wants to know what HR and recruiting looks like when done really well. They'll thank you for it, and so will I. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next episode.